Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you're anything like me, you've probably felt it, that sort of background hum of environmental anxiety.
Oh, yeah.
That feeling that maybe we've passed a point of no return, that things are, you know, fundamentally doomed.
Right, the doom narrative, it's pervasive.
Well, today we're really going to unpack that feeling, because our deep dive is into Hannah Ritchie's book, Not the End of the World.
Mm-hmm.
And her argument, backed by a ton of data, suggests that maybe that doom narrative isn't just paralyzing, it's incomplete,
mm-hmm.
maybe even wrong in parts.
That's exactly it. Our goal today is to really dig into Ritchie's case for what she calls urgent optimism.
Urgent optimism. I like that.
Yeah, it's about providing you, the listener, with a factual kind of rebuttal to despair based on evidence, based on data.
It sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? Urgent optimism.
Hmm.
But it gets right to the heart of it. Are we really locked into disaster, or is there actually a chance to build a sustainable future?
Exactly. Urgent optimism isn't about ignoring the problems. The challenges are huge. The clock is ticking.
Right.
But it's also about recognizing that the data, the historical trends, they show incredible progress. They show these problems are solvable.
So it shifts the focus away from just feeling guilty or paralyzed.
Precisely. Towards action, towards empowerment. And importantly, it's all grounded in empirical evidence, not just wishful thinking.
Okay, so who's the person delivering this this data-driven hope? Who is Hannah Ritchie? Why should we listen to her on such a charged topic?
Well, Ritchie's background is pretty unique for this kind of book. She's a senior researcher at Oxford University.
Okay.
And crucially, she's the head of research at Our World in Data.
Our World in Data. That's huge. Sure. Anyone who doesn't know it, it's like the go-to resource for global statistics on everything, right?
Mm.
Health, energy, poverty.
Everything. And her actual background is in data science and environmental geoscience. So her whole career has been about synthesizing these massive long-term data sets and, importantly, visualizing them.
So she's coming at this primarily as a data person, not necessarily an activist or an ideologue.
Exactly. She's starting from the numbers, from the spreadsheets, which, you know, in a field that can be so polarized, that's really important. It allows for a much more rigorous, nonpartisan perspective. She's not selling a particular viewpoint. She's reporting on the trends she sees in the data.
Okay, that makes sense. It's about that long-term bird's eye view.
Yes. Looking across decades, even centuries sometimes, it helps cut through the sort of day-to-day noise and the scary headlines to see the underlying verifiable facts. And sometimes that reveals progress that we just miss otherwise.
All right, so let's get into the book itself, Not the End of the World. What's the core thesis?
The central argument is actually quite profound. It's that humanity isn't just some kind of destructive plague on the planet. We are also fundamentally problem solvers. We have a track record of tackling massive challenges, including environmental ones, and succeeding.
So the problems we face now, climate change, pollution, biodiversity loss, they're serious.
Extremely serious. She doesn't downplay them at all.
But solvable.
But solvable. That's the core message.
And who is she really writing this for? Who's the audience?
I think it's really aimed at anyone feeling that eco-anxiety we talked about,
mm-hmm.
but also students, policymakers, really anyone who's just tired of the constant battle between, you know, outright denial on one side and total despair on the other.
Yeah, that binary is exhausting.
It is. And the book offers a way out of that, grounded in facts.
And you mentioned her methodology.
Right.
She has a structured way of tackling these issues.
Yes, very disciplined. For each of the seven big environmental crises she covers, she uses this consistent three-step approach.
Okay, what are the steps?
Right. Step one, acknowledge the problem. Lay out the scary stats, the things we usually hear. No sugarcoating. Step two, provide the deep historical context. Show the long-term global data, the trends. And this is often where the surprises are. She frequently shows we might have already passed the peak of certain harms.
Peak harm, meaning the problem's still bad, but the rate at which we're causing the damage is actually going down?
Exactly that. The trajectory has shifted, even if the overall level is still too high.
Interesting. And step three?
Step three is the solutions roadmap. She outlines concrete, scalable solutions that are already working somewhere in the world, things we can actually implement.
Right. So it's not theoretical. It proves there's an evidence-based path forward.
Precisely. It moves it from if only to here's how.
Okay, let's see this in action. Let's talk about air pollution. She tackles this one. It's a huge global killer.
Absolutely. It kills millions every year. But Ritchie frames it as, somewhat counterintuitively, one of our biggest environmental success stories, at least in richer nations.
A success story. How so?
Well, think about London's Great Smog back in 1952. Killed thousands of people. Awful. But the direct result was the UK passing the Clean Air Act pretty quickly afterwards. And that act, plus later technologies like catalytic converters, better industrial filters, it led to a massive, sustained drop in air pollution across Europe and North America.
Ah, so the crisis actually spurred the solution.
It did. And this illustrates a really important concept she discusses, the environmental Kuznets curve.
The Kuznets curve. Okay, what's that?
It's this observed pattern where, as a country starts developing and industrializing, pollution often gets worse first.
Right. Makes sense.
But then it reaches a peak, and as the country gets wealthier, it starts investing in cleaner technologies, stricter regulations, and the pollution levels begin to fall.
So wealth generation initially causes the problem, but eventually provides the means and the public demand to fix it.
That's the idea. It's this combination of wealth, technology, and policy action working together.
And the really hopeful part, I guess, is that countries developing now, like India or China, they don't have to reinvent the wheel, right?
Exactly. They don't need to take the same 100-year path the UK or US did. The clean technologies exist now. They're often cheaper. They're modular. They can leapfrog.
They can adopt cleaner tech much faster, shortening that curve.
Much, much faster. The potential for rapid improvement is enormous.
Okay, so air pollution shows regulation and wealth can work. What about the really big one, climate change? I mean, the common feeling is we've just completely failed there.
Yeah, that's the dominant narrative, isn't it? Failure. But Ritchie argues that narrative is, again, incomplete, perhaps even misleading.
Ow.
Because the clean energy transition, she argues, is now fundamentally driven by economics. It's becoming inevitable.
Economics, not just policy.
Economics are now the primary driver. The key concept here is decoupling.
Decoupling, meaning separating economic growth from greenhouse gas emissions.
Exactly. Breaking that historical link where to grow your economy, you had to burn more fossil fuels.
That seems like a huge claim. Is there solid evidence that's actually happening?
Oh, absolutely. The core evidence is the staggering drop in the cost of renewables. Solar, wind, batteries, their prices have plummeted exponentially in the last decade or so.
Right.
In many places, they are now the cheapest source of new electricity, full stop. We're not waiting on some future miracle tech. The cheap, clean tech is already here.
Okay.
And you can see the results. Dozens of major economies, including the US, the UK, many EU countries have already passed their peak emissions. Their economies are growing.
While their emissions are falling.
While their emissions are falling year on year. That is decoupling in action.
That really reframes it. It's not failure. It's more like a massive economic and technological race against time that we are actually starting to win in places.
That's a much more accurate picture based on the data.
Okay, let's shift gears. Deforestation, another huge source of anxiety. Images of the Amazon burning. It feels relentless, unstoppable.
It does feel that way. And tropical deforestation is still a massive, urgent crisis. She doesn't shy away from that. But globally, the picture is more nuanced. Ritchie points out the world likely passed peak deforestation decades ago.
Peak deforestation.
Yes.
Seriously.
And in many regions, like Europe and North America, there's actually more forest today than there was a century ago. Active reforestation has been happening.
Wow. Okay, that is genuinely surprising. How did that happen? What drove that turnaround in those areas?
Well, ironically, a big part of the story is something often viewed with suspicion. The Green Revolution.
The Green Revolution. You mean high-yield crops, fertilizers, irrigation?
Exactly. Those advances dramatically increased how much food we could grow per acre of land.
Right, preventing predicted mass famines.
Yes, but the hidden environmental benefit was enormous. By growing more food on less land, it spared vast areas from being cleared for agriculture. It's a massive conservation win that we rarely talk about that way.
So the solution going forward builds on that, something called land sparing.
Precisely. The idea is to farm the land we do use as efficiently and productively as possible, using the best techniques, the best crops, so we can free up more land to return to nature, to forests, to wetlands.
And that ties into dietary shifts as well, I imagine.
Huge connection. Richie shows very clearly that shifting diets away from the most land-intensive foods.
Like beef and lamb.
Primarily beef and lamb, yes. They have an absolutely outsized impact on land use compared to, say, chicken or pork or plant-based proteins. So changing what we eat can free up enormous amounts of land. It's about optimizing for impact.
Okay, oceans. Let's talk oceans. First, plastics. The images are horrifying. Turtles tangled in nets, beaches covered in trash. Mm-hmm. The focus is often on, you know, banning plastic straws, recycling better.
Right. And while those individual actions aren't bad, Richie argues they fundamentally misdirect our attention from the real source of the problem.
Which is?
Which is overwhelmingly mismanaged waste systems in a relatively small number of middle-income, rapidly developing countries.
So it's not billions of people carelessly littering. It's more about infrastructure failing in specific places.
That's what the data shows. A huge percentage of the plastic entering the oceans comes from just a handful of major rivers. Think the Yangtze in China, the Pasiga in the Philippines, the Ganges.
Wow.
So the solution isn't really about nagging individuals about straws. It's about massive coordinated investment in proper waste collection and management infrastructure in those key countries and river basins.
Systemic problems need systemic solutions.
Exactly. That's a recurring theme.
Okay, what about overfishing? The idea that we've basically fished out the seas.
Again, the reality is more complex than the headline. Richie shows the core issue isn't fishing per se, it's unregulated fishing.
Unregulated?
Yes, where you have strong science-based fisheries management quotas, protected areas, gear restrictions like in parts of North America, Australia, the Northeast Atlantic. The data shows fish stocks are often stable or even recovering.
So where management exists and is enforced, it works.
It works remarkably well in many cases. The problem lies in the vast areas of the ocean where there's little to no regulation or it's poorly enforced. The solution is clear. Expand effective management globally.
Okay, so pulling all these examples together, air pollution, climate, forests, oceans.
Yeah.
What are the big overarching messages or themes that Richie wants us to take away?
I think one of the most important is what she implicitly calls the N principle.
The N principle.
Yeah. It's the idea that two things that sound contradictory can both be true at the same time. For example, climate change is an existential threat, and the cost of solar power has fallen so fast that we have viable solutions right now.
Ah, holding both the urgency and the possibility together.
Exactly. Yeah. It moves us beyond that paralyzing choice.
Yeah.
Either it's not real denial or we're doomed, despair. The reality is almost always more nuanced. It's serious and solvable.
I also really appreciated her point about shifting focus from individual guilt towards systems thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the obsession sometimes with whether my recycling is perfect while ignoring the bigger picture.
Right. She argues that while individual actions matter, the scale of the impact comes from systemic change. Fixing the energy grid, transforming transportation, implementing effective waste management, regulating industrial pollution.
Those just have vastly bigger levers.
Vastly bigger. It's about focusing effort where it has the most impact, which is usually at the policy and infrastructure level.
And the final theme seems to be learning from past successes, right?
Yeah.
Not starting from scratch.
Absolutely. She consistently points to the Montreal Protocol, the international agreement that banned CFCs to save the ozone layer, as proof that we can do this.
Yeah, that was a huge global win.
It was. Scientists identified a global threat, the world came together, governments acted, industry adapted, and we solved it. It's a powerful reminder that global environmental governance isn't some pipe dream. It has worked before.
It's a template for climate action, potentially.
It's a very strong template.
The book is also full of really memorable lines, sort of crystallizing these ideas. One that stuck with me was the idea that we are the first generation equipped with both the data to see the problems clearly and the technologies to actually fix them.
That's a powerful framing, isn't it?
It really is.
It shifts our position in history.
Right.
We're not just the generation facing the biggest problems. We're also the first generation with the actual tools, the data, the science, the tech to properly tackle them. It's a privilege, in a way, alongside the responsibility.
Yeah. And there's a real moral force behind another idea she emphasizes. Pessimism is a luxury for those who don't have to live with the consequences of inaction.
Mm-hmm.
We have to believe these problems are solvable because we have to solve them.
That one hits hard. Because climate inaction, pollution, resource depletion, The costs aren't shared equally, are they?
No.
They fall disproportionately on the world's poorest and most vulnerable people and on future generations. So giving in to despair, saying it's too late, is essentially abandoning them. Hope isn't just nice, it's a moral necessity that drives action.
Which leads straight to maybe her most direct call to action. The most environmentally damaging thing you can do is give up hope, because hope is what drives action.
That's the crux of it. Hope is a strategy. Without it, why bother putting in the sustained effort required?
Right.
It's the fuel.
So, okay, making this practical. How can listeners use this data-driven optimism in their own lives? What are the real-life applications?
Well, I think the first and maybe most immediate application is internal. It's an intellectual and emotional shift.
Combating that eco-anxiety we started with.
Exactly. Replacing that vague, paralyzing fear with a sense of agency that comes from understanding the problems are serious, yes, but the solutions are viable. Your energy can then shift from just worrying to figuring out where you can best contribute.
And it helps in making more informed choices, right? Not just feeling guilty about everything.
Absolutely. Understanding the relative impact of different actions is key. Like knowing that, for many people, reducing beef consumption likely has a much bigger positive environmental impact than, say, focusing solely on food miles for vegetables.
Prioritizing based on data, not just intuition.
Precisely. And then there's the advocacy piece. Shifting focus towards pushing for those big systemic investments.
Likely.
Like championing policies that accelerate the clean energy transition, supporting funding for waste management infrastructure in developing countries where it makes a huge difference, pushing for better public transit, advocating for sustainable agriculture research, focusing on the levers that create large-scale change.
That makes a lot of sense.
But
thinking back on our conversation, what surprised me most was probably the data on reforestation in developed countries.
Yep.
And also how clearly effective managed fisheries can be. It reinforces that takeaway that progress is often quiet, happening in the background, while the crises get all the attention.
That's a great point. For me, the biggest lesson from Richie's work is this reframing of environmental problems. They aren't necessarily these monolithic, unstoppable forces leading to inevitable apocalypse. They are serious, complex, finite challenges. They require sustained effort, smart policies, technological innovation, international cooperation, all the things humanity actually can do.
It's a paradigm shift, really.
It truly is. The future she paints isn't one defined solely by sacrifice and scarcity. It's about actively building a world that is cleaner, healthier, and more prosperous for everyone, even as the population grows towards 10 billion people. Using our ingenuity to solve problems, not just despair about them.
A powerful and, frankly, much-needed perspective. Thank you for walking us through it.
My pleasure. It's an important book.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.